Tim here, and before the podcast, I have a quick note. Due to rights reasons, the songs have been shortened for this podcast. Every song is taken from the Police's album Synchronicity. All tracks are written by Sting, except for Mother, which was written by Andy Summers. Stuart Copeland wrote Miss Skrudenko, and Murder by Numbers was written by Sting and Andy Summers. It was released on the 17th of June, 1983, on A&M. Enjoy.
Tim's listening party was a lockdown sensation.
Unfortunately, it was on Twitter, which you can't listen to.
But Absolute Radio has the solution.
Tim Burgess explores seminal albums alongside the artists who brought them to life.
Absolute Radio presents Tim's Listening Party with Tim Burgess.
Hi, I'm Tim Burgess, and welcome to another episode of Tim's Listening Party on Absolute Radio. If it's your first time listening, this is a show where I sit down with an artist, going through a classic album and hearing the stories behind it. I've had loads of fascinating chats so far with guests from U2 and the B-52s to Texas and Travis. To catch up on any of these episodes, just search for Tim's Listening Party wherever you get your podcasts to discover a whole archive of past listening parties. Just like Tim's Twitter listening party, a huge part of this is your involvement. So please get involved on social media throughout the show using the hashtag Tim's Listening Party and check out at Tim_Burgess and at Absolute Radio on X for more listening party content. This episode, I'm joined by Stuart Copeland and Andy Summers from The Police to talk about the band's fifth and final album, Synchronicity. It's a classic over 4 decades on and has now been reissued with a deluxe box set, which includes demos that have never been heard before. So be sure to check that out. Grammy award-winning, Hall of Fame inducted, number one, both sides of the Atlantic, critically acclaimed, and multi-platinum selling, Synchronicity is a record that cemented The Police as the biggest band in the world at that time. I was lucky enough to go through the album on a couple of occasions with the band's drummer Stuart Copeland and guitarist Andy Summers. So over the next 2 hours, you'll hear a mix of those two fascinating and honest conversations about the making of Synchronicity. Andy, thanks for joining me to talk about Synchronicity.
Yeah.
I mean, before that, I wanted to talk to you about like your collaboration with Robert Fripp, I Advanced Masked.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, how did you meet up with him? And, you know, you're always interested in different kinds of music and stuff.
Fripp and I, we come from the same, we both come from Bournemouth, you know, and we were very in close proximity, same time, teenagers, same time.
Yeah.
I mean, he was known as this slightly odd guy who lived slightly outside of town, but there was something about him, and obviously he was Robert Fripp and he was going to do this stuff, and he did it pretty quickly. He started off with a band called Giles, Giles and Fripp,
right,
somewhere in there, and he moved it on to King Crimson, which is very much of the time.
Yeah,
not for me, it wasn't music for me, you know.
Right.
I don't know what you'd call it. It wasn't
interesting.
Yeah. But he had a thing, definitely had his own style. He had some technique. He could play in a certain way. It was kind of odd for me to play with him, really, but there's something about it, you know, the fact that we're both kind of well-known now and that we're both from the same town, and both guitar players, and there was a certain thing about getting together. We got together in New York, actually,
Yeah. Playing
a bit at some girl's apartment, and then I'm not sure what we're going to do, but we'll probably find something. We went to this little studio and we kind of made up those albums. Just he would play the way he would play and I would find ways to surround it with something so that each track sounded different. He never really stepped much outside of his own style. You know, he played the way he played and that was it. But, they hold up all these years later.
Amazing.
Yeah. Oh.
So was that kind of like leading up to Synchronicity? Was that kind of like, I mean, it seems like you had a lot of work on your plate.
Yeah, well, I mean, obviously with The Police, it was just nonstop, 24/7. We were living that life at that point. I mean, I've said this in the past. I felt like I could or wanted to, you know, sort of stretch out musically somewhere else and something to do, you know, that wasn't just playing bloody Every Breath You Take again every single night and so on and so forth.
Yeah.
You know, just purely as a musician to challenge myself, to make sure that I wasn't locked into just what we did with The Police, that, you know, I was capable of a lot of other music, and Fripp was at hand, and we had a discussion and decided, yes, we would have a go at it and make a record together. Yeah. As it happened, I had the master tapes, the 2-inch tapes from the old days. I had them, and he asked to get them, and somewhat. I let him have them anyway. Anyway, he found 12 other tracks, outtakes. Well, they weren't even really outtakes, really good. And he worked with them and sent them to me, and much to my quite really surprised at how good they were. And we must have been in a very fussy state of mind. Oh, it's got to be this thing to go on the album, and you know, all that kind of thinking. But anyway, it's made a rather delightful third album, which I think will be in the package in September.
That's fantastic. I mean, that's good timing for this as well.
Well, yeah, let's see how it goes. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think people obviously think of you as, like, you know, a musician who wasn't just in the Police, you know?
No, I hope so.
Yeah, of course.
Well, one tries.
That's
true. I think we all feel that way. You make something that's popular, and then you just get buried alive in it, and you don't really want to be buried alive in one song that goes around the world, but you're lucky if you even get that, you know.
Of course, it's an amazing thing to get, but I think, you know, it's obviously equally as amazing to reinvent and work with other people, and more musical knowledge is the key, you know.
Yeah.
Stuart, it's great to speak to you. We're going to talk about the album Synchronicity. You recorded in Montserrat.
Yes.
What was it like? I mean, were there any shops?
No, there were no shops in Montserrat. There was beer and a recording studio, and that's it.
Okay, that's a great quote. So, Synchronicity 1. I wanted to know, I mean, you know, as a musician, the first thing that you think about when you hear that song is just how fast it is. Do you remember what BPM it was?
Diddle, 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 diddle. Whenever I hear it, it's always slower than I remember it.
Really?
It's one of the few songs that we played the same tempo whenever we did play it, because it had that sequencer.
Right.
Which we were locked to. Diddle, 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 diddle. That's a loop.
Yeah, yeah.
So we had to lock to that. No idea what that tempo was. Let's throw a number out there. 126 BPM.
Wow, it seemed a lot faster to me.
Okay, 146 BPM. Finally, all your listeners out there have been wondering, what was the BPM of Synchronicity?
Exactly.
And now
we don't know.
Still don't know.
What was the process like then, recording? How did he go in? I mean, obviously, you know, we know about the friction between you and Sting. How was it going in to making this album?
Miserable.
What do you remember?
Actually, yeah. We went in full of optimism and good intentions. And in fact, we always did have good intentions.
Yeah.
In fact, we all got along famously. The only time
yes.
we did not get along famously was in band rehearsals and in band recording. Because we all make music for different reasons and make music by different means. And we're all interested in making different music.
Yeah.
And so there's bound to be a clash.
Yeah.
But we all recognize that clash produced a result.
Yeah.
And the clash was not comfortable. We didn't enjoy it.
Of course.
But we did produce something that we're all very proud of.
Yeah. Amazing. Andy, what are your memories about the first track?
Yeah, we did play Synchronicity 1, and it was always sort of weird. But I had a 12-string, and I would start with this. On the live shows, I had my Telecaster hanging over my back, and I'd play half the song on this sort of 12-string on the stand, and I was doing some clever shit on the 12-string.
Yeah.
Then I'd whip it out, whip the other guitar around, and finish the song with the other one.
Stagecraft.
I don't know how long that lasted.
Well, let's play track one from Synchronicity. It's Synchronicity 1. That was The Police with the first track from Synchronicity, Synchronicity 1 on Tim's Listening Party. Andy, tell me about the context of the album. You recorded it in Montserrat.
That's where I recorded the last two Police albums, yeah. Synchronicity, you know, we had primed the public, particularly in the USA, like we were the great band. And we had this album that would have gone to number one. I think whatever we put on it, we had reached that point of
right.
We'd finally really connected. So I think almost anything we would have done would have been a hit, probably.
And what do you remember about, you know, the place you were recording in? Was it George Martin's place?
Yeah, it was George Martin's Air Studios in Montserrat.
Right. And was George around, or did you know him?
We were in a period of tension.
Yeah.
Recording this fifth album to the point where we almost came to a standstill. It was tough, you know. And we knew that George Martin was on the island, living there in his house, you know. And mm-hmm. of course, famous producer, Beatles, all that. And we thought, wow, let's go and get George Martin in. Sir George,
yeah,
he'll sort it all out. He'll make the record. And we thought, there's no way he's going to turn us down because we're the biggest band in the world. Got to, you know, what a gift.
Of course.
So anyway, the actual reality was that we were all sitting there feeling a bit morose. And I got the gig, and I strolled down through. Well, I fought my way through this valley of thorns, hacking my way, like literally with a machete, to get down through this valley and up the other side. God. This house, yeah, it's insane and sort of intense boiling heat. And knocked on the door, and the maid opened the door, and she let me in. And there was Sir George. Oh, come on in, old boy, come on in. And now let's have a cup of tea. So we sat down and we had a nice chat, a bit of a chat. You know, it was more like the confessional. And I sort of outlined to him what was going on. And it was, of course, it's all stuff we'd heard before.
Yeah.
Similar to working with bands.
Yeah, of course.
And but it was very nice to be in his presence. He was a very calming, level-headed sort of chap. Yeah. And, more like an admiral or naval commander or something.
Yeah.
In the end, he said, no, I didn't say, can you take the job, please? I don't know how specific I got, but he didn't want to do that. So he sent me off. He said, no, go back. I think it's going to be all right.
Yeah.
And I managed to get back to the studio. And when I went in, the whole atmosphere, just from the fact that I'd done this little walk across the valley, talked to Sir George, it's like he'd waved the magic wand over us. Suddenly we were very polite with one another and very formal. And we carried on the rest of the album in with very good manners. We went from one end to the other. Strange. You got to laugh.
Goes to show that George Martin's production technique is... Yeah. Goes way beyond just sort of like orchestration. Eleanor and me.
That's really true. It exists on a mystical level, I think.
Yeah. I actually did a session with Giles, his son. It's kind of bizarre, you know, watching all the Beatles videos and everything and seeing George Martin speak on Parkinson and all that kind of stuff. I really did confuse him with his dad quite a lot.
Yeah, I did something at the Hollywood Bowl some years ago. Maybe it was a celebration of George Martin and all his music, because it was we had a huge band and I was in it as part of the show. And Giles was around a lot, so
it's lovely.
Yeah.
Stuart, what do you remember about track two on the album, Walking in Your Footsteps, about the process with that?
Walking in your footsteps, bump, shoot, bump, ba dum, ba dum, bum. Cool song.
Yeah. It's a cool song.
I can't even remember what the drums are. I think the drums were just kind of a percussion thing.
Yeah, it's quite Afrobeat, I suppose. Afrobeat is feedback and, you know, lots of percussion.
It was always awkward to play that song on stage because it wasn't so much about a groove. Oh, wait a minute. That's another one that had a sequencer.
Right.
You know, that's something that...
Was this like the first time you were really using sequencers?
Yeah. They were very basic in those days. Now you can write the whole song, everything.
Yeah.
But in olden times, you could basically set up a loop, and then you record your track around that loop.
Yeah.
There was Synchronicity, whichever one it was. Then there was Walking in Your Footsteps. I don't know if there were any others that had that loop thing going on.
Well, here, that song we've been talking about, the second from Synchronicity, it's called Walking in Your Footsteps.
We'll be right back.
Walking in Your Footsteps on Absolute Radio. Tim Burgess here, joined by Stuart Copeland and Andy Summers for a police listening party. Stuart.
I would like to thank you for introducing me, as well as to Synchronicity, to Stan Ridgway.
Oh, great,
and
yeah.
The Rumblefish soundtrack. And I was wondering, what was the workload like, you know, because it was around about the same time, right?
Well, working with Stan Ridgway was after recording Synchronicity.
Right.
From the hell pit of the police recording experience, I went to the love nest of recording Rumblefish
right.
for Francis Coppola
yeah.
and brought in Stan Ridgway to sing the song for that movie. And I'm glad to have introduced you to Wall of Voodoo.
Yeah, yeah. Result. I mean, wonderful stuff. I remember seeing, you know, lots of... There's a TV show called The Tube.
Oh, yeah.
And I was introduced through you and via The Tube. So you went straight from recording Synchronicity into that soundtrack.
That's right. Straight from... Well, actually, at that point, we were mixing in Montreal.
Right.
And straight on a plane from there to San Rafael, California.
Wow.
Actually, Napa Valley.
Yeah.
Hanging out with Uncle Francis.
Yeah.
The lap of love and luxury in a studio by myself. Just... And by the way, all, you know, you using the material
yeah.
that songs that I wrote for Synchronicity that just weren't right for the band, you know.
Gotcha.
I'm not Sting. I have a different personality. I write about different things when I do write songs.
Yeah.
And so it's great to go over to work on Rumblefish and put all that same material to better use, which got me a nomination for a Golden Globe
yeah.
And a Grammy. Take that, Andy and Sting. Just to be clear, I'm not snarling too badly, because as a result of my material ending up on Rumblefish instead of a police album,
yeah.
The police album, I think, was vastly improved, because the police was all about Sting songs, you know, and his personality. The singer's got to sing them.
Right.
It's got to mean something to the singer.
Yeah.
So no harm, no foul. It worked out pretty well for everybody.
Just one final thing on your Rumblefish work. I heard you started as a rhythm consultant. Can you tell me about this thing called MuSync?
Well, the first thing any drummer needs to learn is how to get rid of the other guy. Because there's only one drum set. You know, drummers actually all get along really well, better than guitarists, for instance.
Yeah, they do.
Yeah, us drums, we all yeah. love each other. But there's only one drum set. So,
yeah.
pal, step aside. Now, with guitarists who all hate each other and are all jealous of each other, there are plenty of places you can plug your guitar in. So there's room, you know, there's physically, but not emotionally, room for more than one guitarist. So, yes, I was called up by Francis just to do rhythm and ended up doing the whole thing.
Good. So you had a plan.
So I got there and used my drummer's technique to get rid of anybody else yeah. involved with the music. I just nuked everybody, plain and simple, one way or another. By hook or by crook. And I bonded with Francis, and wow. we realized that we were on the same page. And this is the way Coppola works, which is that he finds somebody who's he's in tune with and sets them free. And that's what happened with Rumblefish.
It's a wonderful thing. Track number three, Oh My God.
I sometimes get it mixed up with Driven to Tears because it's sort of the same riff. No idea what he's singing about there.
Right.
That's not my job. I bang shit. I'm the riff guy. You know, I never paid any attention to lyrics. I don't listen to vocals. I listen to grooves. You know, I like going back to the Beatles. I don't know the lyrics to any Beatles song.
Right.
But I can sing you every Ringo Starr drum fill.
Yeah.
So, Oh My God must have something to do with religion. Let's go with that.
Yeah.
But I didn't really connect at all with the lyrics until decades later, when I was organizing this material for my orchestral concert of
yeah.
police songs,
yeah.
police deranged for orchestra.
Yeah.
And that's when I actually had my nose rubbed in those lyrics as I'm arranging the vocal parts for my singers, the three soul chicks on the mic. That's when I actually discovered that, damn, those lyrics are actually pretty smart, pretty clever. Dang. You know, dang, the whole thing was kind of a genius with the old lyrics there.
Did you find out anything that you didn't know through the lyrical content, or did he have like a you know, a newfound appreciation then?
Some hidden meanings that I hadn't discovered before. Well, I always thought, having not given it very much thought, I sort of thought I knew what the songs were about.
Yeah.
Until we'd go out on tour and we'd be doing interviews and someone would say, "So, what's this song about?"
Yeah.
He'd explain what it's about. And I'm going, "Oh, really? You don't say."
And how is your orchestra tour?
I've been playing the show for a couple of years now. It's a really fun show because everybody knows the songs.
Yeah.
And when you know, when people know the songs, that just makes it a more emotional experience because the songs have emotional baggage.
Yeah, of course.
So I'm loving playing these songs.
Okay, time for another song. This is The Police with Oh My God on Absolute Radio. Andy's song is next, Mother. It's quite an experimental track, this one.
For some, that is the best Police track ever recorded.
Of course. I mean, I love Andy's work with, you know, with Robert Fripp. And, you know, I'm a fan of this song.
Well, Andy's insane, and this song is bonkers, so it all fits.
You were the biggest band in the world, I would imagine, at the moment that this record came out. I mean, did you ever have anyone saying, "This needs to be more like this," or "You can't have a track like this on the album"? Or
no, during when we recorded our third album, Zenyatta Mondatta,
yeah,
we did have that. The record company, we were recording in Holland,
right?
And it was very convenient for the record executives.
Yeah.
And by the way, this is a great record company. I don't mean to disparage the record company. They were the best record company in the world. But
of
those
course.
Executives were in the studio with us when we were recording. And they're looking at the ceiling, looking at the ground, looking at their shoes, looking, squinting at each other, side eye. Is this the single? Is that the single? Not so sure. And so that was a buzzkill. So the next two albums, Ghost of the Machine,
of course,
and Synchronicity, we went 12 hours flight away from the nearest record company executive so that we could get away from all that.
So that was the reason for Montserrat then?
Yeah.
Fantastic. I love that.
Only problem was that we were 12 hours flight away from the nearest record company, but we're always also 12 hours flight away from anything but each other.
Right.
And there we were on that island, working with the only two people who did not bow down before each other. I mean, outside of that room, we're masters of the universe. Inside that room, we're three sniveling pieces of
That's fantastic. That's fantastic.
And it's, you know, by the way, that's probably a good thing.
Yeah.
It wasn't fun, but it was probably a good thing.
Well, it's good to sort of like get down to the nitty gritty, you know?
Yeah.
Andy, when it came to Mother.
That's a great song.
How did it go then? You presented it, you had a demo of it, or was it just something that you didn't work out?
I mean, it was quite a clever song, written in 7/4 time with a great instrumental break. And it really came out of me listening to, you know, always looking for the hippest, coolest, more out music. I was listening to Captain Beefheart at the time.
Very
and
good.
I think sort of atmosphere for me was like Beefheart, who was a genius. And I came out with this song, Mother, which was also sort of not, let's say it was non-challenging for Sting because it was so different.
Yeah.
It was so individual. And I think, you know, the record company were pretty freaked out that we put that on the album. It wasn't what they really wanted. They wanted a cheerful pop song. I've got
sure.
Sort of dance song, 7/4 time. That's just great, but it worked, you know. And I got to do the vocal on it. We never played it live because it was too difficult. Of course, I wrote a song about my mother, you know, which is a powerful subject. The whole I thought, my mum's going to kill me. She's going to hate this. Of course, she loved it.
That's good.
You know,
that's
I couldn't
good.
Even get rid of it. No, my mum, I'm really sorry. Because she was listening to everything. You know, total fan, the mother.
Yeah, I love that.
The boy, you know.
I love that,
she loved it.
My mum's came to a lot of our early gigs. Always wore the T-shirt. It was very exciting.
Yeah.
Who was producing it, or you know, who was actually pressing the record button?
Oh, that was, we had a guy who was sort of half a producer, Hugh Padgham.
Hugh Padgham, yeah.
Yeah, because, you know, we were also strong and wanting to be the producer.
Of course, yeah.
Like, all bloke. I mean, you got three very difficult guys who are all producers. Because we basically produced all our own albums.
Yeah, yeah.
And left us alone early on. They realized they've got it. We don't need to get involved. Let them do it.
Let's hear it for track number four from Synchronicity. It's Mother. That was Mother by the Police. Next up is Miss Grudenko. Stuart, who's Miss Grudenko?
This is a song about love where it should not be.
Okay.
You know, North Korea, behind the Iron Curtain, where people are strapped into their uniforms and the dictatorship, the dear leader, orders that there shall be no humanity. But those hormones are going to rage. Those hips are going to sway. And love shall break out unheralded in weird places.
Wow.
And that's what that song is about. Are you safe, Miss Grudenko? By the way, that song was made into a movie.
Wow, I didn't know that.
It's not a great movie.
Right.
I mean, I'm really honored that they made such a movie. It's a short movie.
Yeah.
But the entire lyric, I mean, the entire script is exactly the lyric and no more and no less than the lyric.
Oh, wow, it's a nice concept.
The movie opens up with a shot of a Bormi. And one of the executives says, "Are you safe, Ms. Grudenko?" And one of the other board members goes, "Are you safe?" And then somebody else says, "They were holding a policy meeting." And it's like they turned this song into dialogue.
Wow.
Why? I have no idea.
Wow.
Like I say, it's not exactly, you know, Titanic or Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Okay.
But I'm honored
that
they went through the effort.
Yeah, I mean, most of the movies I watch are not Titanic and Raiders of the Lost Ark. So,
well, you'd probably love this movie.
Well, I would like you to let me know how you had a handful of songs to sort of present to the band.
Yes.
And, you know, Miss Grudenko became track number five and was one of them.
Was one of them.
And, you know, the others, you know, went on to Rumblefish.
Well, the Synchronicity Deluxe Package, by the way, has all of these demos of all of these songs, the rough versions at home.
Oh, well, that's great to know.
And you can see, in fact, this is an epiphany, and there's going to be more of this from the Police. We blame it all on the Beatles, in fact. That documentary that they did called Get Back.
Love it.
Where we could see the Beatles in their underpants. The Beatles formulating songs. For non-musicians, it was probably boring as hell, but for musicians to see how the Beatles did it, what their creative process was fascinating.
It's fascinating.
And so we realized from watching that, well, let me preface by saying that our policy hitherto was nothing shall be released except the pristine, final, total, mastered version, and that's it.
Yeah.
But now we realize from watching the Beatles in their underpants that actually those sketches, those demos, actually add depth to the finished result, and that they in no way diminish the gravity of the process. And so in the same way that, you know, Michelangelo's sketches or Renoir's sketches have great interest to art historians, these demos and trial balloons and such are of interest to fans of this music.
I completely agree.
And so you're going to be seeing, you know, after this epiphany, you're probably going to be seeing a lot more of this sort of thing. You know, the other albums we're going to get, because there's demos, particularly the first album, we've got of our live versions of these songs when, you know, before I'd even joined. There's a lot of this material which we'll be digging into.
Yeah, oh, fantastic. I'm very, very interested in the behind the curtain kind of look into a band and how, you know, what makes them tick, and you know early versions of songs. I love all that stuff.
Yeah, me too.
You're listening to Tim's Listening Party on Absolute Radio. Now let's play Miss Grudenko. Miss Grudenko from Synchronicity on Absolute Radio. Andy, the next song on the album is Synchronicity 2.
Well, Synchronicity number 2 has always been a favourite. I think it was one of Sting's better pieces. Mm. I really like the structure of it, and it's very good guitar-wise, you know, because of the chord and the things you can do with it.
Yeah.
Just a really good song, and I like the metaphor a whole lot in this one still thing. But as a guitarist, it's a really nice set of parts to play. You know, it moves through sort of A, B, C, D. It's a different sort of structure. Yeah. It's one of my favourites, actually.
And that was a single as well, wasn't it? They were both singles.
Yeah. I can't remember how they went or how they did. Maybe they were hits. I don't know.
Oh, I think they were. Yeah. I think everything was a hit, wasn't it?
Yeah. I just heard the Police live version of that. I mean, I'll tell you from it, you know, I'm here in Brazil.
Okay? Yeah.
So the other day, about 3 or 4 days ago, we went out on this boat, beautiful motor launch to this island. And I came back and it's a lovely day. You know, one of those days, you know, it just all works. So we're coming back into to where the boat, and he pulls around by this giant thing called Sugarloaf Mountain. And there was a spot where we could swim.
Beautiful.
Yeah, so we're like, all right, yeah, we're all jumping. Yeah, we're a bit, is it going to be really cold or whatever? So we're on this motor launch. So we all jump in the water. And as we jump in the water, this guy set this whole thing up. He puts on really loud Synchronicity 2 at full volume. He drops down this big poster of the Police from the back of the boat. He got us into that. It was a marvelous moment that he obviously had planned over. Anyway.
So, you must have had many, many of those moments.
Yeah, yeah. That was kind of a great moment. Marvellous.
Did you enjoy it at the time? The huge amount of fame and these amazing moments that, you know, kind of would happen because of, you know, because you were in the Police?
I mean, it was an incredible time, an incredible thing to go through. I mean, went on years where you didn't feel like a normal person anymore. One thing about the three of us is that I think we pretty much, partly being together, we sort of managed to somewhat keep our feet on the ground. Nobody turned into a real monster or anything.
Right.
You know, the music we was playing was difficult, you know, and you had to be pretty together to play it, you know. Yeah. You couldn't go on in a weak, you know, shambles state and play that kind of music with that sort of intensity. And we were playing all the time. Playing that music itself was a real discipline that I think tended to hold us all together. None of us got strung out or anything like that.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was a very heady time where you really felt you had the whole world at your feet. Everybody in the world wanted to be with you, to know you.
Interesting.
So, yeah, part of the job was just keeping them away, you know. So intense, you know.
It's like the only bit of privacy you had was on stage.
Kind of. We had bodyguards at either end of the corridor. In the end, it got to a really crazy place. But no, it was fantastic fun. It was like, as you might imagine, being a band like that, to go to that size audience every night.
Stuart, a quick note on Synchronicity number 2.
Yes, that's right. That's the slow one, right? I don't know which Synchronicity is which, you know.
Well, the first one's the fast one, for sure.
That opens the album. That's a mnemonic right there. Okay, this one, something about a dinosaur and a guy having breakfast, and since they're complete opposites from each other, they're a good example of synchronicity.
Yeah, very good.
Because they're in the same song.
Yeah, I love that.
Here it is, Synchronicity 2 on Tim's Listening Party. Synchronicity Synchronicity 2 by The Police.
I mean, obviously, three-piece bands, you know, it's a wonderful thing. Did you ever think about adding anybody else, you know? Or did you ever think what it would be like as a four-piece? Or what would it be like if we were...
Nah.
It's just...
There's already too many of us. You know, both of them ganging up on me, I could handle it. There's only two of them.
Right.
Another guy, you know... You know, at least with a three-piece band, you arrive at decisions very quickly. Yeah. Chinese democracy.
Yeah, the triangle.
Yeah. There was one guy. There's actually two guys who played on Police records who were not blonde heads. One was Olaf Kubler, way back in the day, a German friend of ours that we had toured with in Germany. And he played a sax solo on a track, a very obscure track called Low Life. And then there was Jean Roussel. Who is a piano player with whom Sting hung out in Canada one summer, and they created the demo of Every Little Thing She Does Is Magic. And so Every Little Thing She Does Is Magic has a heck of a lot of big, fat piano on it, played by Jean Roussel. Apart from that, it was just three guys.
Andy, let me ask you this question. You know, the three-piece, I mean... It's very strong and, you know, triangle. Do you ever wish that you were a four-piece or, you know?
Not really, no. I mean, in my early days, you know, there was another guitar player, but the trio is all powerful. It is.
And what do you think it is, then, about the trio?
Well, you know, you get down to the basic elements, you know, well, in this case, guitar, bass, and drums.
Yeah.
It's more difficult, let's say, on guitar, you know, keyboards, okay. You know, piano trio, you got more sound, you know,
yeah.
The chords, you got the, you know, and if the guy starts to solo, you know, and he's playing the solo with his right hand, he's still got the harmonic of the left hand moving, where, because if you play the solo on the guitar, you probably aren't going to have those other chords, so you've got more space.
That
aspect to it, I mean, it's never bothered me at all. Yeah, it's just the magic number, it's three.
Yeah. Very interesting. Did you do lots of overdubs? Were you into
that? Not a lot. No, I mean, I think, again, you know, coming out of the so-called punk era, we were very keen on having this sort of lean, stripped-down sound. Yeah, you know, we're trying to stick to our guns. We liked it ourselves.
Yeah.
I'd rather, like, take, you know, the single guitar and just make it bigger in the mix. Generally, the less instruments you have, ironically, the bigger the sound can be. You can do more with it, you know.
Yeah, it's funny, people don't realize that, do they? You know, it's taken me a while to understand that, you know.
Yeah, well, we came out of an era, of course, when we had punk rock and all these things where the tracks were so loaded with so many overdubs, all in this sort of effort to get this big sound, where it just sounded smaller and smaller, you know.
Stuart, next up is Every Breath You Take.
Ah, the big hit. You know, it was obvious from the minute we heard that song that the song itself... Now, I'm not a song guy.
Mm-hmm.
I regard... And I'm probably totally wrong about this because I'm a drummer. That's what I do. I bang and I'm looking for the riff. I don't even listen to the lyrics. But my wrong point of view is that the song is there to serve the band.
Yeah.
And if you write a cool song, it's there to make the band sound good, because that's what we do. We play music and hopefully sound good, and we have good material to play. But the reality is, outside of this bubble, the reality is that the band is there to serve the song. That's the truth of it.
Okay.
And particularly with a song like Every Breath You Take, where the song itself, just the lyric and the chord progression, not the guitar part, is a hit. It's a huge song.
Yeah.
And even I could see that. But when we first heard it, it was a keyboard song. It was Sting on a Hammond organ type sound.
Okay.
And it was just very simple, you know, and it's all about the song. There was no riff. There was no groove. It was just that amazing song, that story that he's telling.
Mm-hmm.
And it needed something. And what it needed was Andy.
Yeah.
And Andy came up with that guitar riff. He took those organ chords and turned that into a... voice those chords out for guitar, and created that iconic guitar figure. Dirble deedle dee 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 dee, and that's when it all fell into place.
Yeah, beautiful. Was there a moment in the studio where you all actually looked at each other and thought, "This is amazing"?
Yeah, we did that. occasionally. Most of the time, we looked at each other and thought, "You." And it was only actually in the mixing. We actually got along pretty well during the mixing.
Great.
And having fought over what we recorded, once it was all down on tape, the mixing generally went pretty well.
Yeah.
In fact, what would happen is Thing and I would go skiing in Montreal while Hugh Padgham twiddled the dials and made it sound nice. And we'd come back and say, "Sure sounds great." We pretty much sort of agreed, you know. Fortunately, those two other fools had a taste for loud drums, so I was happy.
So Hugh Padgham, he was kind of renowned for this, for like a triggering drums, right? Is that right? Some kind of like delay, drum delay or something? Or
It was actually a little more organic. The effect is as you described, but the process was slightly different. It was actually to record the drums with a natural ambient sound. Instead of recording drums in a dead environment, which was pretty much how you do it up until then, you have the studio with no reflection, no echo, no reverse. It's just dead.
Right.
So then, once you've got it recorded clean with no artifacts around it, no ambience, you can add echo and do what you want. But Hugh Padgham's concept was to have it sounding really cool in the first place.
Yeah, yeah.
So the drums were recorded in a wooden, in the dining hall of the studio, this wooden building with a high ceiling, and the drums sounded amazing in there without any enhancement. And so recording the drums ambient like that was what he brought to the sound. Every Breath You Take did have a click track, old school, just plain click track.
Yeah.
And because we overdubbed everything, including the drums, piece by piece. The snare drum, the backbeat was recorded separately from the kick drum and separately, you know, it was all overdubbed, all the different pieces in that song.
So that was like a kind of, yeah, the kind of, it's a loop anyway, is it a loop of music, whether it's an arpeggiator or not, it's a loop anyway, isn't it really? The verses of that.
Yeah.
Andy, tell me what you remember about this huge hit.
Well, that was great. You know, I mean, I felt very pleased to be number one in America. I mean, this is sort of the sort of goals we would have had in those days. I suppose it may have shifted now.
Incredible guitar line.
Yeah, well, that was the one that put it on the map.
Yeah.
Because that song was going out the window otherwise. We weren't going to use it. We didn't really like it. No.
Yeah.
It was very odd. It was very difficult to get it to the point for Sting and Stewart. They really fought over that one until... Yeah, believe it or not, it's so simple.
Wow.
They really had a fight over it. The only thing that saved it was the guitar line.
Right.
Of course, put it on the map.
Was that something that came later, or was it something that you had in your pocket?
They finally got to, well, okay, I guess the drums and bass are going to go like this.
Yeah.
And there was like half a vocal on it, you know. Like,
yeah, yeah.
As a guide. And, Sting turned to me and said, "Go on, go in there and make it your own. Make it your own."
Right.
So I did. I went in and I played that almost instantaneously, that line, you know, because I had the chops to just do that, you know.
Yeah,
and, was very much in the Police style. And that went straight in. Everybody stood up and cheered. That the manager freaked out and said, "Right, I'm taking this to A&M. This is going to be the number one."
Wow.
It did. It went straight to number one. And now it's $2.5 billion on Spotify. So I'm quite pleased with that.
Pretty amazing.
Yeah. Insane, not million, billion. Yeah, exactly.
It's important to get that across, I think.
Yeah.
Okay, well, let's hear it. This is The Police with the classic Every Breath You Take. That was Police with Every Breath You Take on Absolute Radio. It's Tim Burgess here with another listening party. Andy, King of Pain is the next one up.
Well, I like King of Pain.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Quite a lot to it. I always have to slightly rethink about the guitar part because the bass player is playing a certain thing, but I think we've got it now.
It's great to have that you don't know exactly what you're doing all the time, you know.
Oh, there's a little bit of chance in there.
Yeah, I love that.
I don't know why I was a slight problem with King of Pain. It's slightly ambiguous in the harmonies, and oddly, after he'd done like the first verse and maybe the first chorus, I play the melody along with the vocal. It's something I always did, which is unusual.
Yeah.
Instead of just playing the same sort of set of fifths going up and down, parallel fifths, I go into the melodic line, but it's always worked.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's other bits to it, but it's the only one that I actually have to think about it slightly.
Was there any time that you remember completely forgetting everything?
No.
You managed to get it through.
Yeah, no, I'm pretty good with it. I don't think I've ever forgotten anything.
Can you please, Stuart, tell me about King of Pain?
Oh, well, that's our singer, isn't it? You know, everybody wakes up in the morning with different levels of endorphins and so on, and happy, just basic fundamental happiness. Some people who are tortured by their own brain chemistry.
Yeah.
And such pain sometimes, you know, as a cure for the pain,
yeah,
comes art. And I think that was a very painful time in Stingo's life. And from that pain came such songs as Every Breath You Take,
yeah,
and King of Pain. And that's one of the ones where I actually did kind of notice that the lyric is really cool.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a tiny black spot in the sun today. That's my soul up there.
Wow.
I think Trudy came up with a name.
Yeah.
When she heard him saying that, I think there was a news event or something like that about how, yeah, there's a spot in the sun. That's my soul up there. And Trudy goes, oh, well, that's you. That's you, Stingo, King of Pain.
Yeah.
And thus was a hit created.
It's a beautiful hit.
It's one of my favorite songs that he wrote, actually.
Yeah, it's so good. It's so good. From the Police album Synchronicity, that was King of Pain on Absolute Radio. Stuart Goblin and Andy Summers still join me. Stuart, I mean, I know, you know, most musicians are kind of like quite self-effacive and, you know, very cool and very, very down to earth. And I think, you know, I think a lot's got to be said about you pioneered quite a lot of drum sounds and tech. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Well, I guess by then, I think the echo was beginning to wear off a little bit, you know, the sort of live dub where there was a slapback echo on the drums. Ba-da. You know, I hit the drum once and I get a repeat. Da, da,
yeah,
da, 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 da. And then you start complicating it and you build up and there's this interesting rhythm as the result of the original sound plus its echo multiplying into a polyrhythm. That was one of the main things. By the time we got to Synchronicity, I was just playing the drums. I don't think we used so much of that slapback effect. It was pretty organic, really.
Right.
By that time.
And would you say that was kind of like, you know, just the growth of the band? I mean, at the beginning, you know, you did a kind of, I guess it was like punk and reggae and...
Well, toys come and go.
Yeah.
You know, you find a gimmick or a toy or an instrument or a technique or a cool thing and you do it and then you overdo it and then you get sick of it and then you drop it and you move on.
Yeah.
You know, my Octobands. I loved my Octobands for two or three albums and there was Octoband all, and then I got bored of them. They take up so much room and I moved on to something else and the echo, and then the echo was all over everything, and then I got sick of that and moved on to something else. And that's sort of, you know, guitarists are, you know, usually drummers just play their drums and that's it. It's usually the guitarist who discovers a new foot pedal. Oh my God. And suddenly everything sounds like that foot pedal. In fact, Andy's big discovery, probably was synchronicity, was the guitar synthesizer.
Yeah.
So he hits a chord on his guitar and it generates MIDI to play a synthesizer.
Mm-hmm.
Wow, really cool. And he showed us the thing. Here, watch this. If I hit a chord, you go, whoa. That's fantastic, Andy. Really cool. Okay, what else can he do? Oh, check this out. Okay, I hit a chord. He goes, whoa. That's the same as the other thing. Never mind. And he pulled that out at every opportunity. Oh, no, not the guitar synthesizer again.
Stuart, up next is another big song, Wrapped Around Your Finger.
It seems like the big ones are coming towards the end of the album. I mean, you know, and I mean that in the best possible way.
Well, not my favorite. Not a favorite of mine. I don't get the lyric to the extent that I even listen to the lyric. But it was one of the recordings where we were particularly impatient.
Right.
Where, you know, we would only hear the songs on an as-needed basis. We didn't go and rehearse somewhere and work up the album, then go record it. We would hear the songs. We were in the studio making an album, and Stingo would pull out a song.
Yeah.
Cool. Wow. Let's do that. And we'd work on it. And after him showing Andy the chords, you know, for about 20 minutes, we'd do a take. And I'd go up to the dining room and bang on my drums, and we'd do two or three takes, and that's the recording that's on the album. Now, they would spend the next 2 months redoing all the guitars, redoing all the vocals, redoing everything, but the drums are locked.
Yeah.
Whatever I came up with, spontaneously, 20 minutes after hearing the song for the first time, that's on the album forever. It was completely spontaneous, completely shoot from the hip. All those, the last three Police albums were completely improvised as far as the drums go. Just made up on the spur of the moment.
Would you have done them again if you had your time again?
Well, when we went on tour, I would learn how to get from the chorus back down into the verse. Well, that's how I should have done it on the album. But then the album kind of didn't suck.
Exactly.
But we're on the subject of Wrapped Around Your Finger. That's the one where I had the least sense of where the song is, you know, because he's not even really singing the lyrics. For a simple reason that Sting's bass lines are very challenging to sing with.
Right.
You know, if you're playing rhythm guitar, dun, 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 you can sing along with that. But singing his vocal lines, which are quite interesting rhythmically, against that bass line, which is upside down and backwards, is very challenging. So he didn't really deliver the vocals when we were recording, you know, those recordings 20 minutes after hearing the song for the first time. He's playing bass and he's playing the guitar. And I don't really know what the song's about. And I don't really know when we're going into the chorus. You know, on this song, I can really hear my lack of familiarity with the material as we're recording.
Wow. The upside down and backwards thing is very interesting. And also, I mean, I appreciate, you know, only hearing kind of mistakes in a song. I mean, I only hear that in my stuff.
Yeah.
You know, Every Breath You Take, big hit. King of Pain, big hit. Wrapped Around Your Finger, big hit. Track 7, 8, and 9. I mean, it's kind of the sequencing is very interesting, I think, of this record.
Yeah. That's interesting. I never noticed that before, but you're probably right. There's kind of arrogance there that we don't need to put our... We're so great that we don't need to put our best foot forward. Our not best foot is just fine. But I think Synchronicity was a good way to start the album, and I have no idea what the running order was after that.
Yeah, and walking in your footsteps is good as well. But yes, I mean, these days, I think you would put, like, the first four singles as the first four tracks, you know?
Well, these days, there's no such thing as an album.
Well, these days, there isn't, you're right.
Okay, time for a song. Let's hear Wrapped Around Your Finger. That was Wrapped Around Your Finger. Andy, Tea in the Sahara is the last track.
Mm. It's always been one of my favourites, actually. I do it in my own show, solo show.
Yeah, great.
Yeah, my solo show that I've been doing in the States, I've done about 55 gigs, I think, now.
Yeah.
I have a solo multimedia show, which I may be bringing to England in the new year, if there's time. I've got to go to play in Japan and Singapore first. Yeah, I've got a multimedia show, so I play with a big screen, solo guitar. I have all these photographic sequences, all very worked out.
Yeah.
It's lovely. And I do a Brazilian music section. Then I play the Police stuff towards the end, obviously. And I show this long montage of all the photography I shot of the Police. At the time, you know, which no one else has got, I'm the only one who's got it. So it's kind of sweet. It's been very successful.
And had you been always interested in photography since you were a little boy?
Well, yeah, I started really in the Police. We're in New York. We're being photographed non-stop by photographers. And eventually I said, I'm looking at their gear and all that. And I started to get hooked into it. I've got to get a camera, like a real camera.
Yeah.
So this girl took me down to B&H in New York. I bought a Nikon and I was very excited. And so I started taking photographs. I thought, I'm going to be very good at this. I'm going to do this. Anyway, it became a very strong second string to the bow, if you like. You know, I started to photograph all the stuff on the tour.
Yeah.
Got more lenses, then I had this big bag of cameras and lenses I was slogging around with. Yeah, and that's where it started. And, you know, it's gone for years. I've done about 65 exhibitions now. Several.
I love that. That's so great. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, Stuart, what can you tell me about Tea in the Sahara?
Now, that is a cool song.
Yeah, it really is.
About a book, something about a desert, something about three sisters, and I don't know what it's about, but once again, it's very cool. Cool vibe.
Yeah.
And I do that with my orchestra thing, and I recorded that song, and I sent it. After I'd recorded these songs with my soul sisters on the mic, I did a world version where I did it in 20 different languages, Every Breath You Take in Zulu. With the Soweto Gospel Choir and Tea in the Sahara in Chinese.
Wow.
By my friend Sui Chan.
Wow,
who's
wow.
A huge Chinese rock star, and he did Tea in the Sahara in Chinese. I couldn't resist. I had to send that one to Stingo just to imagine him going cross-eyed, because this Chinese singer Sui Chan, he's not just Chinese, and Chinese is a difficult language for singing. Not only that, but he's the Chinese Bob Dylan or Tom Waits.
Oh my gosh.
He's not exactly Mr. Melody. He's got an incredible charisma, style, and he's the coolest of the cool, but not Mr. Melody. And so his Chinese version of Tea in the Sahara brings a smile to my face to imagine Stingo hearing that.
How did he meet?
He called out of the blue and invited me to do a show with him. Now, he is sort of the troubadour whose songs were being played during the Tiananmen Square demonstrations many years ago.
Right.
And his songs are like were the anthems of those protests. So the Chinese government kept him not under lock and key, but they kind of kept him quiet.
Right.
And finally, decades later, they let him do a big stadium show. And he invited me to be in that show. It's one of the most emotional concerts I've ever been to. They knew every word to every song. The production was huge.
Wow.
It was just my hair is standing on end when I think of the emotional impact of that show.
Yeah, that's a great story. Okay, back to the album. This is Tea in the Sahara from Synchronicity. The Police with Tea in the Sahara on Tim's Listening Party. Andy, one last question for you. Did you have a lot of songs to go in with, or was it more experimental?
It was always very competitive, but Sting would bring his songs in. By the time we got to Synchronicity, he pretty much refused to sing anything else. Yeah, they were weaker or stronger to an extent.
Uh-huh.
You know, they all had to be played by the three of us for it to sound like the Police.
Of course.
That was the ingredient. The thing about the Police was that it was always an act of transformation, taking material that was, to some extent, fairly raw and the more sophisticated. And, well, not, I don't even want to say sophisticated, but more like the individual sound of the Police.
Yeah.
You know, we had to get it to that place where it sounded like us. And
became
very conscious about that.
I guess in the beginning, you know, you had a lot of reggae influences and it's kind of like, you know, a lot of the songs had that kind of, you know, familiarity kind of, you know.
Well, actually, I'd like to comment on that because we didn't have a lot of reggae influences.
Okay.
We were alone when Bob Marley became big in England and reggae ran. No, we weren't. All we liked was the fact that you could do that sort of halftime bass line, which gave the singer much more ability to sing in a space instead of having a bang out 16th or 8th note like a la punk at the time.
Yeah.
Purely musical. I didn't have particularly have interest in Jamaican culture or reggae or anything like that.
Uh-huh.
So I think we used the bass line thing as an element in our own music.
Right. I mean, obviously, my reference points would be kind of, punk and reggae kind of happening at the same time, you know, I guess with Bob Marley and just thinking about the kind of rebel dread and Clash and sort of like that those times. I mean, I was 11 years old at that time, so I guess it's just my view of it. And you know, I guess like Roxanne and Can't Stand Losing You. And then by the time you get to Synchronicity, it's kind of like there's hardly any elements of that.
Yeah, it got more sophisticated. I don't know if that's the right word. I hate to use that word. Definitely took on a different sheen, if you like. But yeah, I mean, the atmosphere when we started was definitely punk and reggae because they, you know, the punks said, you know, who had so-called rules about everything, you know, just, oh, they're sort of not the moron. You're punk. So you're supposed to be this little rebel-free guy with a shaved head. And yet there are rules.
Yeah.
That's not punk. This is punk. That's punk. Doesn't make sense. But they liked reggae.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was very much the atmosphere. You know, so I think even the early records, the early stuff, even Roxanne sort of comes out of not so much the music of the time, but the atmosphere that was around us, which was kind of strong, you know, and you had to have something edgy.
Yeah. I mean, it was a great time for me to be 11 years old, getting 7-inch singles.
Yeah, 11, it'd be very exciting.
So I guess, I think my point being is that, you know, you were talking about the three of you sounding like the Police. I mean, obviously the sound evolved as the band grew. I mean, you were the biggest band in the world. All your singles were huge hits, as far as I can remember. Even early stuff was re-released and that became like the massive hits as well, like, I guess So Lonely. And, you know, so when I hear Synchronicity 1, it sounds to me like the Police. You know, it's like, there you go, it's the Police.
Yeah.
When I listen to Walking in Your Footsteps, I mean, it kind of does too, because I mean, I saw you on Top of the Pops every time, you know, you had a single out. So to me, it all sounds like the Police.
Well, maybe, you know, in this case, we were so popular that maybe the audience sort of identified with us at the point. So the sort of slight moving on in stylistic aspects.
Yeah.
Cool. You know, and the audience just went with us and they accepted it.
Yeah. Yeah.
They didn't say, well, can you first say, well, it's nothing like Can't Stand Losing You, so I'm not interested anymore. Everybody stayed on course.
And yeah. That's exciting.
The odd thing about the Police was, well, like, you know, people, oh, you must have been with all these bands and you know this one. I don't know what they're talking about. And I think really partly the reason for that in our period was that because we were always on the road.
Yeah.
You know, seen in England, there was this band. And I go, what? You know, because we were playing all the time. So in a weird way, we were the number one British band and we didn't know what was going on in the British scene because we were always doing it.
Maybe too busy because, you know, just flying around everywhere and getting in back of cars and doing interviews and playing
all
and,
that. Yeah, all
videos.
That.
Yeah.
Full on. Yeah.
Stuart, I have one final question for you. Who would you say were your top five drummers?
Mitch Mitchell, Buddy Rich, John Bonham, Ginger. How many is that?
That's four, but that's fine.
That's four. I mean, I, you know, Keith Moon is on there sometimes and then not because he was a screw up.
Yeah.
I mean, he played some amazing stuff, but he also played some crap stuff too. How many, is that five?
Yes.
Yeah,
okay, five.
Buddy Rich, Mitch Mitchell, John Bonham. Hey, Ringo's got to be in there. Can we do six?
You can
Ringo
do six.
Is, you know, he's not underrated because people are really rating him these days.
They are.
But that's new. Back in the day, he wasn't rated so much as he is now because we now appreciate. In fact, of all the ones I just mentioned, he is probably my godfather more than any of the others because his contribution wasn't flashmatronics.
No.
He didn't do fancy drum fills. He didn't do things that were required superhuman autistic practicing, such as the rest of us musicians are engaged in all the time. His contribution was a matter of taste and creativity. Anyone can play what Ringo played, but no one else would have thought of it.
Well, here's the thing. So I'm in a band called The Charlatans. We opened for The Police.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And our drummer, John, who is not with us anymore, he died in 2013.
Oh, shucks.
But you were his favorite drummer.
I like him. Nice lad. Good lad.
Yeah, he's a good lad. Yeah. And we played with you and...
I remember the name.
Yeah, and we were playing... It was in Europe. And we had a lot of smoke on the stage and it was our last song. And I walked off and I was going down the stairs and I couldn't find my way because there's so much smoke on the stage. And... a hand reached out to me and it was like Michelangelo's sort of like creation of Adam. And I reached out to hold the hand and I was led down the stairs and it was Sting.
Oh, bless him.
I know. So I was happy to be Adam and Sting was playing God. So that was wonderful.
Yeah, yes. Yeah. Now you know what it's like to be in the police.
Well, there you go.
And let's just to follow the simile a little further. There's Stingo as God, but his band were just entirely unruly and deserving of plagues and floodings and other tribulations. We were, I have to say, in all the most crap minions ever. Well, I mean, it was just thinking, you know, I woke up every morning trying to, let's make Sting happy. He's written some darn good songs here. He's an incredible musician. His ideas, even when he's suggesting something for me to do on my instrument, on my hi-hat, God damn it, that's not necessarily a bad idea. So I wake up every morning, or I used to wake up every morning, today I'm going to make Stingo a happy guy. And that would last about 10 minutes because, you know, when I'm banging stuff, I'm not a thinking human being. The person talking to you now is urbane, kindly, you know, safe with children.
Yeah.
Thoughtful man. But the guy banging drums, no, so, yeah, that's an 800-pound silverback swinging through the trees.
That's fantastic.
And with all those good intentions, as soon as I start banging, get out of my way.
Stuart, we're going to finish with track 11, Murder My Numbers. What do you have to say about this one?
Actually, it's not on Synchronicity. That was a B-side of something that might be on Synchronicity now, but it wasn't back in the day.
Okay.
And it's one of my favorite songs and should have been on the album. And when I play this show live, it burns the house down. It's one of the most popular songs that I do live. Love that song.
Well, let's hear it. Murder My Numbers, which concludes the new deluxe box set reissue of Synchronicity. That was The Police and Murder My Numbers, concluding the listening party. Thanks to Stuart Copeland and Andy Summers for joining me on this episode of my listening party to tell you all about that classic album, Synchronicity. If you've heard the show before, you know I like to end each episode by telling you what I've been listening to recently. I have been listening to Clear Spot by Captain Beefheart and his band. Actually, his magic band, which is, it's a classic and... You know, I
like a lot of his records, but this one in particular just sort of like is chiming with me at this very moment. I've been listening also to Jordan the Comeback by Prefab Sprout. It's a fantastic record. There's so many tracks in it. It appears to be a double album, but I think it's actually only a single. That's beside the point, I suppose. The album is fantastic, and check that out. It's an oldie but goodie. I really like this record by Astrid Sonne, S-O-N-N-E, and the album's called Great Doubt, and it's very minimal and heartfelt to the point. Very good for me to listen to in my own time, you know, which I don't seem to get a lot of. But when I do, I like to choose my records very, very well, and that's one of them. And I've been listening to We Love Life by Pulp, basically for the reason that the song The Trees is my favourite record of theirs. Every song is taken from The Places album Synchronicity. All tracks are written by Sting, except Murder by Numbers, which was co-written with Andy Summers. Mother, which was written by Andy Summers and Stuart Copeland, wrote Miss Credingo. The album was released on A&M in June 1983. See you next time.
Absolute Radio, telling the story behind another iconic album with Tim Burgess.
Get involved using the hashtag Tim's Twitter Listening Party.